The Carver Barnes Lecture Series is the oldest endowed lecture series in Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. It was founded originally by some students, and later it was endowed, or the endowment was completed, by two couples from Missouri, Mr. and Mrs. Lee Fechner, who are the parents of Mrs. Nancy Byard, and by Mr. and Mrs. Lee Beaver, who Mr. Beaver was a longtime trustee of this institution. The first lecturer was Dr. Theron Price in the spring of 1961. And through the years, we've had a distinguished list of people, women and men, who have helped us with the understanding of our history and of our mission, that which so appropriately underscores the names of those persons for whom this series is named. William Owen Carver, the first professor of missions in any theological seminary in the United States, and W.W. Barnes, professor of church history at Southwestern Seminary. Seems to me to be very appropriate today that our lecturer first saw the light of day in the state of Missouri, from which our benefactors have come. Nancy Tatum was born into the family of a Baptist minister. She secured her early education in the schools of Missouri, received her baccalaureate degree from Southwest Baptist University at Bolivar, Missouri, and I learned in speaking with her a while ago that her professor of sociology at that school was Dr. Betty Hefner, who was one of my first students in sociology when I taught at William Jewell College between 1953 and 1956. I take special delight in mentioning that here today. Dr. Ammerman is a PhD graduate of Yale University. She serves as professor at the Candler School of Theology, where she teaches the sociology of religion, and where she also serves as director of the Baptist Studies Program. She is a careful researcher, an engaging writer and speaker, and many of us in this room today have been the beneficiaries of her insights into the organized religious community of which we and of which she is a part. Her most recent book, Baptist Battles, Social Change and Religious Conflict in the Southern Baptist Convention, combines that quality of research which marks her as an effective sociologist and the narrative of a participant observer who is really one of us. There are other details about her given in the program, and I shall not take further time to repeat those, but to welcome her most cordially to this Carver Barnes lectureship and to this platform, and we shall hear gladly Dr. Nancy Tatum Ammerman as she gives the first lecture, Organizing to Do God's Work, Denominations, Past and Future. Dr. Ammerman.
Thank you, Tom, and it was indeed a delight to discover that we have that link in Betty Hefner to Tom's past and my past, and to know that there have been people teaching sociology of religion in Baptist colleges and seminaries over the years, and that I stand today in that, what I would like to think of as very proud and useful heritage to our denomination. It is truly a delight to be here, to be with you in this place at this time. It's a delight to be among friends and to finally actually get to Southeastern. You have a beautiful campus, and it's wonderful to be among you, for these couple of days. And to have the honor of giving these lectures named for these two very distinguished scholars in our past as Southern Baptists. It seems to me that we stand in these late days of the 20th century at the end of an era. What it has meant to call oneself a Southern Baptist will never be the same again. And the way of organizing that has given expression to our identity as a denomination is very much undergoing change. There are new ways of cooperating emerging, new coalitions emerging, a new sense of what it means to be a Baptist. And how all of that will turn out, it seems to me, is very much still up for grabs. But what is clear is that the future of the Southern Baptist Convention is really no longer in doubt, particularly since the summer of 1990, if not before then. What had been clear for some time to a few people became clear to even more. That summer, it seems to me, provided a number of kind of pivotal turning events that made clear that the future of the Southern Baptist Convention was in the hands of people that I'll call this morning fundamentalist. I won't spend a lot of time explaining why I use that term, except to say that these are people for whom the future of the Southern Baptist Convention of necessity needed to take a turn in a conservative direction that for them represented a returning to roots, to fundamentals. And a group of people who organized to actively achieve that goal. They now are in charge. And among the pivotal events that made that clear in the summer of 1990, it seems to me, or among other things, the election that year. For years, moderates have been declaring that every year's presidential contest was really the final showdown, but the 1990 election really was. Moderates had learned from 11 years of defeat, and they, in 1990, felt like they were doing everything right. Everything, that is, except getting enough people to New Orleans to vote. They didn't even come close. And it was finally apparent in that defeat that the moderate political movement was dead, and that for the foreseeable future, fundamentalists would be able to elect whoever they chose to lead the Southern Baptist Convention. And electing whomever they chose meant, of course, that fundamentalists would have the assurance that they would be in charge in the schools and institutions of the Southern Baptist Convention. They'd, of course, already begun that process of changing the policies and the personnel in Southern Baptist schools and agencies, a process nobody has to tell anybody here about. At that convention meeting, however, there were a number of other things that began to be apparent about the direction that fundamentalists would take the Southern Baptist Convention. It was in that meeting, of course, that the Baptist Joint Committee was finally completely severed from Southern Baptist Convention support. And it was not long after that convention meeting that a special meeting of the officers of the Executive Committee was convened to dismiss Dan Martin and Al Shackelford from their positions at Baptist Press. And it was in that summer that it became apparent to people affiliated with the Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville that the trustees there also wished to engage in a certain amount of house cleaning and rearranging. It was that turning point summer in 1990 that was the scene for a called summit conference of sorts. Daniel Vestal and members of Baptist Committed decided it was time to gather a few of the moderate leaders and figure out what to do next. They figured they'd have a couple of hundred folks get together in a conference room in a hotel in Atlanta and talk about the future. Well, they called some other members of the left wing of the Southern Baptist Convention, people in the Alliance, Women in Ministry, the staff at SBC Today, and word went out Well, it soon became apparent that a hotel conference room wasn't going to hold the crowd that wanted to come. So on August 23rd of 1990, 3,000 concerned Baptists gathered in the Inn Forum in Atlanta. And before their gathering was over, they had formed an interim steering committee. And they asked that committee to promote community, to develop funding proposals and mission statements, to communicate a sense of renewal to Baptists, and to plan another meeting. Now, nobody could say then where the plans and proposals of that meeting of concerned Baptists would lead us. But it was very clear that this bunch of people wanted to do something new. In that meeting in Atlanta, whenever a lone voice would raise an objection that maybe if we could just hit on the right political strategy, we could finally defeat the fundamentalists. To that lone voice, a chorus of others responded with a unanimous no. That's not what we want to do. That group of people meeting in Atlanta left calling themselves just the Fellowship. But the movement began pretty quickly to take on more enduring shape. And by the time we gathered in Atlanta again last May, there was a constitution to approve, missions projects to fund, and a permanent coordinating council to elect, and an official name, even if it was changed on the floor, to the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. And the question that we kept getting asked was, are you forming a new denomination? You're forming a new denomination, aren't you? And our difficulty in answering that question reflects more than just the uncertainty of our future. It also reflects the ambiguities of Baptist polity and the rapidly changing form of denominationalism in American life. The attempts by the Southern Baptist Convention's progressive wing to redefine itself in these years are unfolding within a rapidly changing American religious context. But it also, what we do is formed by our heritage as Baptists and the rather ambiguous boundaries that our polity gives to us in all of this. We Baptists have for a very long time, if not from the beginning, said that what we would do is organize ourselves as free souls in democratic churches that retain their local autonomy while cooperating at least with some sort of local association of other Baptist churches. But as we have entered each new era in our denominational life, we have modified what it meant to live by those principles of autonomy and democracy. In our earliest days, in the 17th and well into the 18th century, we probably practiced pretty much what we preached. But as our practices have changed, we, for the most part, have never quite figured out what to preach to describe what it is that we're doing. The first crisis came in the 19th century when Baptists were first beginning to organize beyond the local level. We had discovered the dream of carrying the gospel to the ends of the earth, and we began to feel just how much good we might be able to do if we banded together beyond the local level. And so we formed the Triennial Convention, and we participated in a host of mission and benevolent societies that were cropping up all over the American religious scene in the 19th century. Each of those societies with its own purpose, its own sense of mission, and its own governance. Local churches sent money, sent representatives as they saw fit. And plenty of Baptists were plenty offended by that kind of organization. They argued that there was no biblical justification for any kind of organization beyond the local level. And so part of what we read in the history of 19th century Baptists is the history of the anti-mission movement. The second crisis that came in our attempting to figure out how to practice what we preach came in the early 20th century, when it became apparent just how successful all that organizing of the 19th century had been. There had grown to be just too many good causes, and a great deal of potential overlap of effort in organizing to support those good causes. The watchword of the day in American culture was efficiency. American business was succeeding mightily in those days under that banner of organizing efficiently, and American churches vowed that they were not going to let God's work be done any less well. In the early decades of this century, American Protestantism centralized in order to be more efficient, and Southern Baptists were no exception to this trend. We all know, of course, that it was in 1925 that we put our cooperative program into effect. By 1931, we had worked out the kinks of how to have a trustee system, how to think about who would be represented at annual meetings. We had a constitution in place, an executive committee that took responsibility for budgeting, and so forth. And again, plenty of Baptists cried foul. If mission societies were an affront to our local autonomy as Baptists, then surely this new bureaucracy must be of the devil himself. There was plenty of argument, and no less than J. Frank Norris led the charge in opposition to this new centralized way of doing things. Centralizers won over Southern Baptists in the decades after 1925. Partly by giving us some biblical warrants for collecting our money into a pool from which we would do good work, but mostly they won us over by the sheer weight of the efficiency and success of what they had put in place. We were proud of what we had put in place and the way it worked to, in fact, spread the gospel around the world and build attractive and successful churches here at home. By the 1950s, a good Southern Baptist church was defined primarily in terms of program. A good church gave at least 10% of its budget to the cooperative program and avoided non-SBC causes. It got its preacher from an SBC seminary. It purchased its materials from the Sunday School Board and had all of the recommended programs as a part of its church activities. It sent its youth to Baptist colleges and to seminaries. It sent its lay leaders to Glorietta and Ridgecrest. It would vehemently deny being liturgical, but it followed the denominational calendar religiously. As one layperson recently remarked, if we didn't have a handbook or a pamphlet from Nashville, we didn't know how to do it. And as Richard Groves, president of the Alliance, replied, more tellingly, we probably wouldn't even have thought of doing it. Southern Baptist practice over these nearly 70 years, it's been a curious mix of local autonomy that we do have sermons for, and the centralized efficiency whose growth and success we have been very proud to boast of. Now, it's still the case that a local church is first and foremost a member of some sort of local Baptist association, and it contributes to that association for local benevolence, and it can be disfellowshipped from that local association for violations of doctrine and practice. And it is still the case that that local association has no necessary organic tie to any other part of the Southern Baptist body. To be a member of the Southern Baptist Convention simply means that a local church declares itself to be in friendly cooperation, which generally is taken to mean that it gives some money to the cooperative program. If people give more, they get more votes at the annual meeting, but there's no particular official designated minimum gift to be a member, no official doctrinal statement to sign to be a member, and no official requirement that you have to be exclusively loyal to Southern Baptist causes. The Constitution that was put in place in 1931 left a lot of room for ambiguity in our relationships with each other, and the centralizing won not by the weight of official law, but by the weight of practice. Now, that a denomination with such a loosely constructed congregational polity, like we have, could become so functionally centralized makes Southern Baptists a prime example of the organizational form that we as Americans, not just as Southern Baptists, have taken as really the equivalent of what we mean when we say denomination. When we say denomination, we think of somebody's headquarters somewhere. We think of Nashville. We think of Louisville now for the Presbyterians, or Chicago now for the Lutherans. We think of a place that collects the money, that divvies it up, that counts up things. Now, polity makes a difference among those various denominations in terms of whether those people in Louisville own the property, whether they can officially promulgate doctrine, and whether they officially appoint the pastors. But the kind of everyday life, the way things really work, looks pretty much the same across denominational lines, and it has become a part of our culture in the 20th century to think in these terms. Now, fundamentalist churches, historically, in the Southern Baptist Convention and otherwise, have never really bought into this system. Certainly in the SBC, they were never really considered very good citizens of the Southern Baptist Convention because they didn't play by those centralized rules. They were less likely to support the denominational programs and more likely to support what we came to be willing to call, with a kind of sneer, parachurch organizations. You had to learn to say that just right. Fundamentalists were afraid that Nashville was too liberal, so they got help from fundamentalist publishers. And they knew that Southern Baptist seminaries were too liberal, so they got their preachers from Mid-America or Dallas Theological or Criswell. Moderates all those years tried hard to label these folks as not real Southern Baptists for behavior like this. But the official polity was on the fundamentalist side. Now that fundamentalists have won, some of them are becoming a little more cooperative. They're sending more of their money and program support requests into Nashville, but not nearly all. And not surprisingly, moderates are now rediscovering the advantages of that decentralized official polity. Now that what comes from the official denomination is less to moderate liking, they're beginning to join fundamentalists in that parachurch market out there, albeit on the opposite ideological side of the fence. Other moderates retain that sense of disdain for those special purpose groups that we've called parachurch organizations. They've learned their lessons well from all of those years of being loyal to the cooperative program. And many of those moderates would like most of all to be able to answer those reporters about, are you forming a new denomination, with the answer yes. And what they would like to do is basically to substitute new content, new people in charge, and keep the basic kind of centralized structure. They like the way things worked, they just don't like who's in charge now. If that view of the future prevails in either the fellowship or the alliance, the result will obviously be a clear schism, because churches will be asked to support one centralized structure rather than another. They'll have to make a clear-cut choice, either or. There's something of that same kind of dynamic at work among some of the alliance churches that are leaning toward joining the American Baptist churches. It's a little different because part of what many of these churches are doing is seeking dual alignment. Without leaving the Southern Baptist Convention, joining the American Baptist churches as a way of expressing a desire for reconciliation, particularly across the North-South lines that divided us in 1845, but also across the black-white lines that were the reason for that division in the first place. But what that represents, at least in part, is, again, acceptance of the existing kind of organizational structure with its mission boards, retirement plans, and so forth. That disdain for parachurch organizations, along with the wariness of the ABC that most Southern Baptists have, loyalty to the cooperative program, all of those things are functioning today as very powerful deterrents to any kind of schismatic movement within the SBC. People have learned to think about denominational support as really an all or nothing affair, an either or kind of affair. Many moderates who are very unhappy with things that are going on in the denomination today still feel like as long as there is a single missionary out there that they want to support, they have no choice, they think, but to give all of their money through the cooperative program. Other Southern Baptists aren't seeing any choices these days because they aren't looking for them. About half of the denomination appears to me to be convinced that what has happened at the national level really doesn't make any difference. They've listened to all those sermons about our official local autonomy, and they think it's true. They'll keep on ordering all of their literature from Nashville. They'll keep on calling the seminaries and officials at their state conventions for help with a pastor. They'll keep on calling in help from the denomination in structuring what they do at their local church. They'll keep on sending people to Baptist colleges, to Glorieta, to Ridgecrest. They'll learn from those places how to do what they do in their local church. But of course, the denomination doesn't have any effect on the local church. As long as they believe that, they simply won't be looking for other alternatives. And because this great middle half of the Southern Baptist Convention really is very conservative, the rhetoric of the fundamentalists is very reassuring to them. They're reassured to have Bible believers in charge of the denomination. And their loyalty, along with the enthusiasm of those who really do occupy the right wing of the denomination, will probably ensure that at least 80 to 90% of existing Southern Baptist churches will remain firmly within that centralized denominational fold. So the constraints of Southern Baptist habits are very real. They'll keep the vast majority of the denomination intact with that central organizational structure. The opportunities of Baptist official polity, though, make room for a considerable amount of innovation among any who choose to change their habits. They can invent new programs, they can link with non-denominational agencies, or they can link with other denominations, all without ever officially severing Southern Baptist ties. And what we are doing in this time is going to be then constrained by our Baptist polity, but also will happen within the opportunities that are presented to us by that polity. It also takes place in the context of a rapidly changing American religious system. Those parachurch organizations that some are turning to now and some have been affiliated with over the years are not just affecting Southern Baptists. They are a part of the American religious scene that has grown very rapidly since World War II, and particularly since 1960. Robert Wuthnow, in a book called The Restructuring of American Religion, has argued that we are seeing the erosion of the old way of thinking about how denominations work, and we're seeing the growth of a kind of entrepreneurial sector in the American religious market a sector occupied by organizations from Campus Crusade to Bread for the World, from the Religious Roundtable to Fuller Seminary to David C. Cook Publishing and Sojourners. Those specialized religious organizations are made possible in part by a whole round of advances in technology and by innovations in organizing that come from business, among other places. We can now organize by way of conference calls and fax machines and electronic mail and modems. We can keep a whole broad network of people together without ever having to gather them under one roof. Electronic banking and sophisticated computer programs make possible all kinds of designations and complicated formulas for giving. Desktop publishing makes huge printing presses and big publishing houses less necessary. It's no longer necessary even to get everybody under one roof to vote. So more and more churches, not just Southern Baptist ones, are seeking out non-denominational agencies out there in this free market to do their mission outreach for them, to get church literature from, to be their voice in Washington, even to educate their clergy. So local churches may be, nominally at least, affiliated with a denomination and have a certain brand name on the door, but the local congregation may be making a whole variety of choices about how they affiliate beyond the local level that will make a very real difference in what it means to have that denominational label on the door. Likewise, what's happening in the pews inside those congregations is having a real effect on what we think of as our denominational identities. You may have noticed that people are rather mobile these days. You may have noticed that people are getting more and more education, learning that there is a big, complex, plural world out there. And people simply aren't as tied to some of the old traditional loyalties that used to hold people within denominations and even within local congregations. We simply don't live in the same places. We're no longer tied to the old place and family and ethnicity that used to define us in some very real ways. People are increasingly willing to move to a new place and shop around for the congregation that seems to best fit their way of thinking and their lifestyle. And that congregation may or may not have the same tradition, the same brand name as the congregation in which they grew up. So at that kind of individual level, we're finding all kinds of blurring of what we've come to think of as denomination in this country. Indeed, I think the whole meaning of the word denomination is under tremendous strain these days. For most of this century, it has meant those centralized organizations through which churches were linked to causes beyond their location. But today, those organizations, as we've seen, are under stress from the competition. But they're also, in the main line, under stress from three decades of membership decline. They're under stress from a very unfavorable kind of business climate in which they have to exist and buy very expensive insurance and property and so forth. Those centralized organizations are showing real signs of weakness. So if denominations in that form are no longer going to define our sense of what it means to organize together as a body beyond the local church, where are we going to turn for our sense of what it means to be a denomination? Will we turn, perhaps, to theologians? Well, that's a possibility, and certainly for the first centuries of what we experienced as Protestants, of growing into our Protestantism, we were following theologians. We were following theologians who had such powerful new ideas of what it meant to be a church, what it meant to be a follower of Christ, that many of those early Protestants named themselves after those theologians as Lutherans and so forth. Clearly, beliefs and practices have been a part of what we have defined for ourselves as the meaning of being a denomination. And clearly, denominations still fight and divide over beliefs and practices. But there aren't very many theologians out there today with new ideas who are calling people to live in new ways as disciples of Christ, calling people to organize in new ways to support those ways of believing. Indeed, most of the theologians of the academy have long since given up doing theology in a denominational mode. We learned early on that denominations, after all, are human creations, and too often likely to reflect human divisions. So for most of this century, theologians have largely operated in an ecumenical mode. While they may today return to at least some role in helping to define what it means to be a part of a particular denominational body of believers, they probably won't be the only, or perhaps even the leading role, play the leading role in that process. So if we can't turn to organizations and we can't turn to theologians for defining who we are, what do we turn to? Well, one of the residues of the organizations and of the theologians is that there are some curious sort of denominational identities out there. Out there in the culture, the denominations in their lives together over all of these years have produced subcultures. Now, they've produced subcultures in which people grew up and learned the language and the ways of being a part of that subculture. They've produced subcultures that could be stereotyped and laughed at by outsiders. And even today, without any particular organizational support for a lot of that, those identities linger on in our culture. One of the things that has fascinated me over the years is to look at surveys that are based on asking people, what is your denominational preference? And the person answers something like, you know, I'm Presbyterian. How often have you, or when was the last time you were in church? A couple years ago. Are you a member of a church? No. Do you want your kids to be raised Presbyterian? It doesn't really matter. Very, very tenuous kinds of organizational ties and beliefs. I mean, this person may not even know enough to be able to name the first book in the Bible, or to tell you who preached the Sermon on the Mount. But nevertheless, that person who says that their denominational preference is Presbyterian is going to be different from the person who says that their denominational preference is Lutheran or Baptist or Catholic or any of a number of other things. Somehow, those preferences pick up on those lingering identities that are present in American culture after generations and decades and years of organizations and theologians creating that identity. That form of membership, however, it seems to me, is pretty tenuous. And I wonder how long it can survive without the organizations and the stable subcultures to sustain it. Having become so very mobile and having learned so very much at school, will our children still claim to be Baptist? Especially when they didn't grow up in GAs and singing Just As I Am. So all of these recent trends in American religious life pose significant questions about what we will mean when we say we are a part of a denomination, what we will mean theologically, what we will mean in terms of our sense of identity, what we will mean in terms of how we organize. And if all of those meanings for our sense of identity as denomination are under attack, that means that this is a particularly opportune moment for beginning to redefine and rethink our own sense as Baptists of what it means to be a denomination. It means we might finally figure out how to preach about our practice while we're in the process of inventing some new practices about which to preach. Over our history as Baptists, we have put together our way of organizing in a variety of ways. We have always been passionately committed as Baptists to spreading the gospel, first in our local communities, then organized in ways to do that task throughout the earth. Over the next few years, Baptists are going to be doing some experimenting with how to continue to do that task of missions. We're going to be experimenting with some new alignments, some new coalitions within the old body, some new alliances across denominational lines, and probably some very complex networks of people linked up to a variety of special purpose groups, parachurch organizations. But as long as we remain committed to both evangelism and local church autonomy, we're going to continue to struggle with how to find the channels through which to participate with God in God's work in the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ammerman, for helping us to realize who we are as Baptists, who we have been, something of who we are becoming, and the very complex forces that are shaping us. We look forward to the lecture tomorrow as we continue this examination. But before then, I would like to invite you to join us today in the cafeteria for a Dutch luncheon and discussion, and there we can continue to look at these important questions and issues that Dr. Ammerman has raised this morning. Will you pray with me now? Excuse me, before we pray, I didn't tell you what time, did I? And I worked so hard on that too, to figure out how more of you could come. The luncheon is from 12 until 1:30, so if you have a 12 o'clock class, please come at 1. We'll still be talking. In fact, we'll probably be doing more talking then. And so come if you can and join us. Let us pray. Now may the peace of God go with you as you go forth to serve God and others.